speaking in their normal voice, or perhaps an abnormal voice that you won't recognize, but this is about as loud as it gets. On behalf of Augusta, I'd like to welcome you. This is the fifth in a series of discussions that we have had running from the first week through this week. These are funded by the Humanities Foundation of West Virginia. And they provide us with the funds and the opportunity to bring all these fascinating and fantastic people here to talk about the things they do, to talk about how they started doing them and why they continue doing them and what the value of their activities are. This is a very special week. The people before you have been honored nationally and internationally. It's a real honor to have such a stellar group together at one time. Moderating the panel tonight will be Margo Blevin, who is the director of Augusta.
Chills going up and down my spine sitting in this company here today. We've been having many, many discussions through the week, and when I was putting together this series, which is called Common Threads, a series of discussions that has been going on throughout the 5 weeks, and this is the final panel discussion, I was having the pleasure of looking at all the unusual and experienced and just amazing people who are going to be gathered here this week, and trying to find what they had in common to choose a theme for each week's panel discussion. And the theme that I saw became very, very clear to me. And it was brought back to my mind when I was listening to Utah Phillips today, speaking in his morning class about the elders and the wisdom of the elders and how our society has neglected to appreciate that wisdom and to utilize it. And I was reminded of the statement that if we don't learn from history, we have to live through again and repeat all the mistakes of the past. There, the people in this room, including many of you here in the audience, have seen a great deal of change in their lives and seen many, many things and experienced many things which shed a lot of light and wisdom on life itself. And I've asked some of those who I felt had a great deal of experience, and I think this is a common denominator by which the panelists, the people up here, were chosen, come up and discuss some of their life experiences with us and with one another. But I also felt, and as you can see by the seating here, this is not formal, this is not a stage, that everybody in the room has something to contribute to this discussion, and therefore the circle goes around and is completed so that you are all part of this panel discussion as well, although I don't think we'll have time to get around to hearing everybody's story. I want everyone to feel free to contribute to this and to ask questions too. But I was very anxious to be to bring some of the people who we had here who have experienced many changes and seen many changes in the world throughout their life, and have them answer some questions for us and perhaps raise some questions for us to be thinking about. And one of the things, another thing, Utah, you've gotten everybody just talking about so much today, or this week. One of the things that has been discussed this week in various places are the fact that people have thrown away the ability, or lost the ability, to remember and retain and pass on history and stories that we've relied so much on mechanical means. Everybody's got their tape recorder out and is recording things. Everybody's got their video cassette out and they're recording everything. And we have everything recorded so we don't have to remember anything. We've got it. And all of you, of course, can remember time when you had to remember things yourselves, and you probably have much better memories than we do as a result. I would first like to have each person up here on the panel introduce themselves, and very briefly, because we'll come back to each of you in turn, very briefly tell a little bit about yourself and what you do, where you live or where you grew up, and more importantly, how you decided to become a person who passes the art forms of the past on to other people. When did you make that connection? When did you become aware that you were somebody to whom that was really important? I know it's hard to answer that in less than an hour, but I'd like to start with you, Ian, and then perhaps just go around and have everyone briefly tell a little bit about themselves.
Well, I come from Fort William in Scotland, which is 120 miles north of Glasgow. And I don't think there's anything special I do or anything. Why I came to be doing this at all is because a certain gentleman wrote me for 2 or 3 years asking me to come here, and I refused resolutely every time. His name is George Balderos, and he's an agent, you know. He takes on musicians and he tickles them around the USA, and he does a very effective job. I found him so honest and upright, and in every way I found him an outstanding man. And I didn't know that when he started writing letters to me. I had no idea what he was like, but I did know what agents were like. And I took nothing to do with them in Scotland at all, but I had a wee bit background of playing the fiddle and teaching young children and some older people too. Actually, I teach regularly about 2 dozen people at home just now, and I do it in the evening after I come home from work. I'm with the North of Scotland Hydro Board. I've got a big area, it's about 6,000 square miles to cover, so it keeps me pretty busy. But I devote this 4 nights a week to teaching the people, and they're mainly grown-ups, teaching them just the music of my area and the surrounding parts of Scotland. I would teach them more about other people's music, including your own, but it takes a little while, and maybe as the years go by, they'll learn that too. But I believe in starting at home. And the one thing, as I say, George Balderos took me out here, and we've had a wonderful time, and it's a great time for us to come out once a year, do a wee tour, and come here for a week. And I enjoy teaching the people the fiddle. And by the way, they're an excellent class this year. And I call them the Elkins Scottish Fiddle Group. But if I took them back home to Scotland, they'd be very much accepted there too. But thinking about the traditions makes me think of an African missionary one time, an elderly missionary. He was traveling in a deep part of the jungle, and he was driving along in this broken down old car that he had, going to the next congregation about 20 miles further up the track. And he came, there had been a bad storm, and as he came round the next corner, there was a tree right across the road. And he wondered, what on earth, how am I going to get past this? He had traveled a long, long distance. He didn't want to go back home. So he was pondering on this when, from the other direction, a huge lorry came with about 20 blacks on the back of the lorry, and they were singing and chanting away and having a good time. And they suddenly saw this tree in front of them too, and they just kept on with their little chant, and they came down to the tree, and they caught that tree, and as they chanted, they just carried this huge heavy tree to the side, and past went the truck. And then they took the tree and they chanted back again. And there was the road sealed, you know. And the missionary, he was sitting there still on the wrong side of the tree. So he went up to them and he said to them, you know, can I get past? And certainly, of course we'll get you past. And back they came and they got the tree, sang their wee song and opened the road for him. And through he went, and then they sang the wee song, and they put the tree back again. And sometimes I find that with music. Instead of us going out and being open-hearted and telling the music, and I find that a lot in Scotland. People say, I've got this, and I'm going to keep it to myself. I don't want anyone else to get it. And all of a sudden they die, God decides the light's going to go out. And before they can leave anything, it's gone. So I've always felt if I've got anything at all and it's of any use to anyone, I'll tell them. And you know, all it does to me is if I can tell somebody one little bit, by the time they've discovered that, I might have another two little bits that I know about. So we're all progressing. So with me, it's tell as much as possible and spread the gospel of the music.
My name is Ben Hawker, and I am presently living along the east coast of Virginia, a place known as the Eastern Shore, which is above Norfolk, across the Chesapeake Bay from Norfolk. I was born and raised in and around Danville on a tobacco farm, and I was brought up in the old Primitive Baptist Church, and we only had meetings once a month, every second Sunday, and I grew to like that old singing, and it seemed to have began to die away over the years. And last year, I made a tape for my children, my four children, and while I had a reasonably fair voice, and I sang some old songs on there, and told some stories. And my daughter lives in Glenville. When she got her tape, she let Michael and Margot hear it, and she called me and said, "Daddy, they want you up there at Elkins." I said, "What for?" So she said they like those old songs, and I haven't been able to find anybody that were interested in those in recent years, and I was simply elated because I thought that it seemed that I was going to have to carry those memories to my grave, and I'm just amazed at the people here that have accepted my way of singing and my philosophy so far, and I just feel like a page boy among in the King's Court here now with all these people.
My name is Howard Sims. You can call me Sandman. I was born in Baja, California. It's right on the Mexican border. And quite nice, there's nothing there but sand. I started at an early age because I came from a dancing family. I came from a mother and a father that was devoted to dancing, but they didn't have a chance to exploit it like they should because they came along in the wrong time. And I never had a lesson. I never was taught. I never remember when I started. I just knew I could dance. And I'm very thankful that I discovered my talent when I was young so I could devote time to it and develop it. And after developing it, it was so nice to me and give me such a nice opportunity to be around nice people like you till I had to give it to anybody I could, maybe it would help them. And that would draw people together more closely. And I noticed that if you can satisfy people, you're accepted. And this is what I'd like for everybody around me so that they'll be accepted. If everybody's accepted, we don't have any more grief. So I devoted my time to giving, not receiving, giving, because I didn't have to pay for this talent that I have. And the Lord, in a way, gives everybody a talent. And if you discover it early enough and develop it, you can use your talent. But if you throw it away and put it in the wrong surface or the wrong ground, it won't come up. But if you put it in the right soil, it'll come up and you can distribute it. And by you distributing it, the world gets an enjoyment out of you doing what you're doing, not because you're doing it, because everybody wants to do it, and everybody's able to do it. And like I say, I'm very happy that I had a privilege to come here and give it to these kids, because it's priceless, and I'm not getting a price I'm not asking for a price. I just ask for the opportunity to give and not to receive. Most of the times you hand your hand out, it's like this. But when you can hand it out and do it like this, it's much better. And all my life, I've been enthused about doing this, not asking, giving. And I find it very nice to give something to somebody that can do something with. I don't have time to do something with it all the time. And if you want it done, you give it up yourself. So, and the best thing to do is give it to those that's coming in. Like, we have a very distinguished way of exploiting our time. In America, we do away with the antiques and the relics because we're always looking for something new. And we're destroying what we really have as our heritage. We give up all of our real good heritage for new ideas, which is air floating. And it has a tendency to carry our youngsters in the wrong direction. It gives them a sense of not being able to distinguish the right thing from the wrong thing. And they get a big kick out of getting something new and adding something to it because the old is obsolete to them. If we stick to our rules and our regulations and think about the age that we have come through and the relics that we have and use our relics instead of killing it off for something new that's not worth the paper it's written on, I think we would come by more strong in our belief in each other. And right now, the things that the young kids out here today are catering to is the wrong thing. And it leads up to one thing and it leads to another, and it's just it's outrageous. And look like if we don't do something about it, we are lost. And we are the ones that's trying to save the ones that's behind us. What we should do is put them back on the right track and put them back in that grind that we came through that brought you through. You know, you had to have somebody to help you come through. And when you get up to the age of where you're supposed to help somebody else and you ignore that, your time is wasted and you don't have that much time in the world. Your time is the greatest fortune teller ever was. In time, you don't know everything in time, but these kids are not living in time. They're living on time, and time, their time is running out. Before, look, you don't have as many like we do. We're here. They are just coming in and going out the next day. Time is one of the most used words in the English vocabulary. Me, myself, and I, and time. Do I have time to do something? Do I have time to do this? I have time. Am I taking up too much time? I mean, have you got time to sit down and listen to me? This is what we own. Now, if we wait and use time, we'll know everything, because right now, we don't have time to know anything. And when your time is right now, you're not supposed to be able to be afraid to do anything, because everything has been done before. There's nothing original on this earth, on this planet. Nothing is original. We are not qualified to look at something that's original. We don't have that originality. We have lost it by not giving back and bringing it up to where we can realize that this is original. We should never be afraid to do anything, because everything's been done before. And giving is not anything to be afraid of. A lot of people is afraid to give because they say, if I give you what I got, you'll be greater than me. Greatness is giving. That is giving. Greatness is giving. And if you are great enough to give, who can be any greater than that? Here's what we should do. When you leave this earth, you shouldn't have but one regret, whatever you did, big or small, large or any size, whatever, right or wrong. Did I do my best? If I didn't, I wasted my time. And a lot of us don't cater to our best. Some of your best is giving. That's your giving. Some of your best is giving. If we didn't get from somebody that gave to us, we wouldn't be here. And all I'm trying to say is, give till it hurts. We'll have some.
Know how to start after that.
Give it to him.
you know me. I probably will. This is my relative sitting right here. I was born, when you're speaking of time, I wrote a poem. I was born in the mountains of North Carolina, Ashe County. And I grew up. There was music all around us. And we never had to lock our doors. We didn't have no push buttons, and we didn't know we needed them. And I said, one of my favorite sayings is that I'm not against progress if it's headed in a good direction. And another saying is that I learned, my grandfather was an old mountain preacher with a beard about that long. But one thing I would like to say first, me and my family and husband and brother, the young people in the colleges and places have really done a lot for us. I mean, they listen to you, they listen to you, and they not only want to learn out of a book, but they want to learn how to live too. And that is very, very important, like you said, how to live. And my grandfather used to tell us about different things, and he was a preacher, Primitive Baptist preacher, but he always told funny jokes. He said, you're supposed to laugh. And what you said about each other, you know, I said, it's no wonder that they've taken the old Bible and revised it so we could understand it. Because what we do to each other, it says as oft, and that's O-F-T, as oft as you've done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me and yourself, whoever the maker is, wherever he is. And I figure that I've been blessed an awful lot in my time. And don't ask me how I ever got started, because when I was in school, I played Mama Bear. We used to have operettas in school, and I played, had the three bears, and I was Mama Bear. And I used to sing in the churches. And we didn't have, the only radio in our area was one of them old black ones like that, where you had to put them big things on your ears and run the aerial all the way to the top of the mountain, Osmond, you know that, before you could hear it. And don't ask me how I knew or learned where a theme song came from. I used to take this old guitar that belonged to my uncle, and I'd go into the parlor. That's where they said, come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. Yeah, he knows that. I used to get up in front of that when I was about, just a little, barely could see in it, and take that guitar and sing my theme song. Now, how did I know? You tell me, how did I know what a theme song was? I'm not saying we was pitiful because we didn't have radios. Somebody said to me, you had to work in the fields, you had to do this, you had to do that. And news reporters will come to my house and they ask, you came from a poor background. I said, by your standards, you might have called us paupers. But there wasn't enough money in the world to buy what we had. We knew how to live. We knew how to, if there wasn't no push buttons, we knew how to go out and find something to eat, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
He came from right close to where I did. And what I'm trying to say is that it's not me. I think the young people and the college kids and all of today, they're really interested in your way of life, knowing how to live. My favorite saying is, if you like potatoes and I like beans, I'd be very stupid to walk up to you and say, your potatoes ain't no good, wouldn't I? And like I told them at the Academy of Music, you know there's more than one culture in the world, be it in music or whatever. And we're all a part of these. We're all a part of each other, whether we know it or not. We are, and if we can pass that on, you younger people are gonna be the ones to, I don't mean that you don't go forward and learn, but I mean to carry on a tradition that we may all need someday. Just what you said, we might need it someday. And he told that there Scottish joke. I told this lady one today. My grandfather was always telling Irish-Scottish jokes. We lived right along, I'll tell you this and I won't bother you anymore. We lived right along New River in the mountains. There's a mountain on that side of the mountain all the way around. And there was big tall trees, and she knew what they were, bomb butt trees, bomb trees. bumbut. They grew way high. And then there was weeping willows that grew down below them, leaning out over the water. Sometimes them trees would be way out over the water. He said there was 12 Irishmen going along the river, and one said to the other, and he said, "Faith in Christ, Isaac," he said, "the tree's thirsty. Look at it, it's leaning out." So they tried to figure out what they were going to do. And the strongest one, he said, well, he was going to climb all the way up and at the top. And he said, "We'll just pull it, all of us get together and we'll pull it over so it can get it a drink." So the next one caught a hold of his feet, and his feet, they climbed up. And the last one was down in the water up to here. And he says, "Boys, you better hurry." He said, "I'm going to drown." And the tree didn't budge. And the man that was holding at the top with all 12 of them holding on to him says, "Faith in Christ, boys, all of you hold on tight below while I spit on me hands." I've just played all of these years, everywhere. I've been every place where they never heard. They asked me why. Dr. Henry Glassy, I'm sure some of you heard of him. Years ago in his early years, he worked a lot with me. And he was talking about the ballads and the songs. He said, it's like a portion of time and history preserved in song. And he helped me an awful lot in the beginning when he was working to get his degrees. So I said, a so-called, he taught me that a so-called intellectual. Wait a minute, my dad used to say, if you're going to be a, where's my husband? I don't want him to hear me say that.
I heard you say everything.
My dad, I tell him that I'm not a dirty person, and I don't say dirty words. But my dad used to tell all the boys, he was a school teacher in the mountain, he said, "Boys, if you're going to be a shoveler, be a good one and you'll be a success. And if we don't have a few, we'll be awaiting it up to here."
Well, I was born and raised down in Russell County, Virginia, in the lower end of the county, down pretty close to Tennessee. And I was born in 1890, December the 26th, and raised up on a farm. My daddy grew this little corn, orange potatoes, and things that way. Had a few sheep, just a very few. And we're just poor folks, you know. And I lost my eyesight when I was about 20 years old, pretty much, you know. I'm blind in one eye and can't see a little out of the other one. And I didn't know what to do, you know. And I wanted to make music, you know. And we were poor, didn't have no pans or nothing. And me and my brother and first cousin, we went to the creek bank, cut a willow tree, and made a hook, you know, for the rim of the banjo, and then went to the hill and cut a cedar tree and made a neck for the banjo. Well, then we killed a cat, skinned this cat, and stretched that hide across that hook, you know, for the head, and made a homemade banjo, you know. I learned to pick the banjo that way a little bit, you know, on that banjo. Well, then I thought maybe I'd like to fiddle some. My daddy was a fiddler. And I'd catch him out, you know, and I'd get his fiddle, you know, the best for him. Finally learned how to play the fiddle a little bit. And so I just kept on, you know, and learned to fiddle. Try to fiddle a little along now, you know. And that's one reason I'm up here, you know, to tell a little about my life. And so when I was a boy, well, there wasn't no such thing as a hard-topped road, you know. No car, or nothing like that. Just dirt roads, you know, and you walking or ride a horse or something, if you went anywhere. And I just grew up on the farm way back in the country. And so I learned to play the fiddle a little bit, and I like that, you know, and that's why I'm up here now.
He said he's still fiddling around. Well, I guess it's my turn. I wouldn't know what to start with, just like the rest of them.
Yeah.
But if I could start, I might not be stopped. I was born in Calhoun County. I was born in 1908. And I've practically been there all my life. I moved away once after I got married. We got tired of living there, and we moved away over on Middle Run, inside of Lockney. Wasn't too far. But every time we come to that store, we thought we was coming home. We just could turn around and just come back at the same, that same fall. We moved in that spring and we come back that fall. So we have still been there all ever since. And when it comes to talking about music, I learned to play a little the way he is talking there. I don't know, banjo, you couldn't play nothing on hardly. A tin banner to beat it. And I just wanted to play. I just wanted to play bad. And I just kept on till I kind of learned. My brother wouldn't learn me nothing. And so I just had to learn myself. And I didn't hardly ever see anybody. Nobody but one or two had a banjo. That was, you know, wasn't too good, but there's a lot better than one I had. We had. And so I learned to play a banjo a little. And I learned to dance. I was dancing when I was 4 or 5 years old. I guess it was just born to me, I guess, but I danced. And I danced all the time. I danced, they couldn't keep shoes for them. I didn't say they used to get her no shoes, she dances a map. That's not what I done. And so we lived around there, and we didn't have no tape recorders. We didn't have no nothing, you know, like we've got now. We're rich now to what we used to have when I was raised up. We didn't have no televisions. We burnt kerosene lamps and burnt pine knots for light. We worked day and night. We worked away in the night, you know, raising a crop. That's what, and all the money we had wasn't any. We didn't hardly have any money. And my father and my brother sang and got money. It was, you know, a pretty good price to buy a little stuff out of the store with and a few clothes. So I think we lived up, I think we was raised up very, you know, very poor. But what did my mother and father's, their grandfathers, their grandmothers, what did they live at? They lived under rocks, I was told, a lot of them. They lived under rocks. And they had a good time. They was the stoutest people you ever seen, yeah. Seemed like, they told about. And so they'd kill deers for meat and hogs. Sometimes they'd get a hog, wild hogs. My dad told me his dad had killed many a wild hog. And so we got along very well. We loved one another, and everybody come there. And if my mother wouldn't turn nobody away for something to eat. Stranger, any kind of person come to our house, they was welcome. They come in, if they wasn't room, they slept on the floor. Now that's how my mother was, and my dad was the same way. There's this he said, that give. They'd rather give as to receive. So we got along, I thought, fine, just extra well. We went to people's houses and had meeting, and, you know, a prayer meeting. And we had it at our house. And then when all the places we had to go to was to a dance. We got to dancing, okay? We'd go to this house and dance, and to that house, and to that house, and they'd come to our house, and just like that. And they wasn't no hard top roads when I was growing up. I walked too many times, walked out there on the hill to the store where we had to go for miles out through that ridge. And we'd have to wait there till the groceries come in before we could get a few groceries. See, we had chicken. We could sell chickens and eggs. Now that's and get stuff. And so I remember it'd take them 3 days to go to Spencer and back. They had to go on horses and wagons and buckets. They put buckets. They put buckets over there and feed your horses. Stay all night and stay a night or two. And if they come in, people sitting there waiting for to get stuff to, you know, to go on. Had to have stuff. And I went to sleep in my mother's lap one night, waiting on. I'll never forget. And it was 1 o'clock before we got back home. We'd worked all day. They had, well, I didn't do much when I was literally 11, you know. But they'd worked all day and we was off tired. And we'd raised corn. And my mother, when I first seen her, she had gray hairs in her hair, in her temple. And she said she was about 50 years old when I was born. And she'd put a bushel of corn on her back, and we raised two of her sons, they young'uns. And she'd take that there girl on her back too, and I was afraid, but she'd just tell me to watch for snake. You know, we was afraid of them snake. And how that woman ever could do that and her that old, I don't know. But now she'd go and milk her cow in the night and feel for the cow sack to milk her. They had her, you know, in the shed. We had a cow, and that's all we had, a cow, and some chickens and hogs and stuff like that. And I think I've had a very fine, nice life. I really enjoy it. I learned people, as he said, I've learned lots of people to play the banjo. Now, lots of people goes playing, I don't want to learn you nothing. You're liable to beat me. Now, there ain't nothing in that. You're learning now, and they can't take yours away from you. You've got that. You'll always have that, you know. And I think you're to learn and help people out. I have everywhere I've went. I've helped people out and learned them how to play, and they made the best banjo players you ever heard. And I was glad of it, and that's about all I've got to say.
Altogether now. And I'm sure over the weeks since I've been here, you all know where I came from and my background, most of you at my workshops. We came off a despised race, which was more even than being poor. We were desperately poor, but we were not wanted. And to this day, in many places, we still are not wanted. And the very hard thing about it, no doctors would give us medical attention, regardless of what illness or sickness we had. No religious person would accept us. And that's very hard. I know we were never at school. None of my people were ever schooled. And I had 1 year and 5 months schooling. But I never had to do the real traveling life, because my father died when I was 7 months old. And going back to the older generation of the tinkers or the traveling people, if the husband died, the wife never ever took another husband if she had children to her first man, because she would never have a second man rule the children that she had to her first man. But of course they were never married in the first place, because no one would marry them. But seemingly the gypsies hold a marriage ceremony on their own. Our people didn't believe in that. If the man saw the girl or the woman he wanted, fair enough. And if she saw the man she wanted. Well, if nobody wanted you, you were despised. Why should you go to a third person and say, can I take this man, can I take this woman? Nobody wanted you. You were bound to know within your own mind if you wanted the person you thought you were going to live with. So that was it. But I was a wee bit more fortunate. Because when my father died, my mother moved to Blairgowrie to pick raspberries when I was 1 year old in July. That's the raspberry picking season. I had two brothers. My oldest brother was about almost 13, and my other brother was 6 and a half. But there were family in between that had died in infancy just through hardship and other things that went with our way of life. But that was the three of us that were spared to my mother. And she moved to Blairgowrie and picked the raspberries. After the crop season was finished, she went to a solicitor. She wouldn't know what that word meant, but that's what the man was, a solicitor in the town. And Blairgowrie at that time was very, very rich in jute factories. Well, there was always these jute workers that lived in very old derelict houses, you know. So my mother was lucky. One of these houses was empty and she got that house to live in. Because in that days, if a traveling woman went around the country on her own without her husband, just the law stepped in and took the children from her. because they said a woman was not fit to look after a family and travel the country. And that was all wrong. Because it was the traveling women that did all the earning of money and collecting food and begging and going around. The men lay around the campfires until the women came back. It could be maybe a child in arms, perhaps pregnant with another one, and a wee one at the hand. But the men did make the pots and pans, and the baskets, and the horn spoons, and all that went to earn some money. They were all self-taught. No one's a learner, just picked that all up on their own. But the women had to face all types of weather and go from door to door selling these articles. If they had nothing to sell, they just went begging from door to door for whatever the people was kind enough to give them. But the men slept around the campfire, so if the man did die, the woman was really the provider in the first place. So that's why my mother had to go and live in a house, or my two brothers and myself would have been taken from her. So I grew up in a house. I didn't travel at all when I was young. The first time I ever really traveled as a traveling tinker was when I went to Ireland with a brother of mine. I would be about 18 at that time. We went to Pearlfish. My family were very, very great pearlfishers. And Ireland is a very rich country for freshwater pearl. And so is your country here. Very rich country for real pearls, you know. I don't mean saltwater pearls, cultured pearls, no. Freshwater pearl. Because I have a nephew back home. My son, my two sons still do it every summer. We've never lost that. But I have a nephew that lives beside me in Blairgowrie, and his sister married a man from New York City and lives there. So he came over here about 2 years ago. Of course, he didn't know where the rivers were, but his brother-in-law took him to where there was fresh water. Rivers, not the big ones. And he came back with about 32 or 33 good pearls, and he was only over for 3 weeks. But you couldn't go into the big rivers, it had to be the smaller rivers. But the one thing about the pearls in this country, there's so much pollution in the water, they don't keep the colour so long. But back in Scotland, the freshwater rivers that we have, well, there's not nearly so much pollution, and the pearls keeps their colour. But still, this is still a rich country for pearls. You just know where to go for them. I can't tell you, I don't know where the rivers are, but if I did, I would tell you. We'd all become rich overnight. But that's what my mother did, and I went to Ireland, as I told you, when I'd be about 18. That's where I met my husband, but we knew them back in Scotland. And the reason they went to Ireland, many, many families did that, not only travelling people, but local people of the place. First World War, 1914 war, there was a compulsory call-up for young men to go to the army and go and fight for their king and country. Now, what on earth had the travelling people country to fight for? They wouldn't allow them to pitch a tent in only any piece of ground. They were moved on, were despised. You can't be here, you can't be there. So, rather than be called up for the army, an awful lot of them went to Ireland because there was no compulsory call up there. That's why my husband was, from he was 12 year old, in Ireland. He wasn't army age, but he had brother-in-laws and brothers and uncles and other relatives that would have been called up. So anyway, my brother and I went over to a place called Swanland Bar in the County Cavan. And the river wouldn't be as big as from this lady to me here. And my brother Andy, my father, who became my father-in-law, they said, we'll go and see if we get a few pearls today. They got 38 pearls in 1 hour and 10 minutes, timed themselves on a watch, in that very small thing. Practically every muscle they opened had someone to show, you know. They weren't all very big ones, but then the smaller ones, they keep that for setting in brooches or rings or, you know, the small, small pearls. So that was really a lucky shot. Anyway, I come back home, and we'll be about 6 months back home, my brother and myself, when my older brother wanted to go back to Ireland. Now, the reason I went with them was they had to take a train from Blairgowrie to Glasgow, to Buchanan Street Station, Now, people that couldn't read nor write and had never been in big cities, it was a bit of a problem to know, when they came out of that station, how to get to the Broomie Law where you got the vote, because there were ever so many streets and names. Well, I wasn't a scholar, but I could have still distinguish the names on the streets, so that's why my brother took me with him, or I wouldn't have been back the second time, just to know the way and ask the way down to where we got the vote. My brother was fishing a river called the Moy. It was near a village called Tubbercurry in the county of Fermanagh. I even know the names of the places where the rivers are. I just wish I was there now in this good weather. And yeah. There's still a lot of pearls. So my brother got a very, very large pearl. It'd be about just an hour in the water. Now, the way that the travelling people, when my father was alive, used to have their pearls weighed, because you get paid so much a grain. Pearls are bought by the grain weight. Now, they couldn't go to jeweler shops or anything to have them weighed, because I don't think they let them in their shop. But they used to go to a drugstore where they used to weigh the medicines, you know, the powder, the medicines, and that by the grain. And that's where the pearl my father got when I was born. And it was 42 and a half grain. It was the largest pearl that has ever been found in the River Tay. There's been one recently by a local man. It was 34 and a half grain. But there's never been one of that amount, that size and weight, has ever been found in the River Tay before. But coming back to those Irish pearls, my brother got that one anyway. And Ireland, well, we did go to Burnaslow, and they said there was a very good jeweller there for buying them, but the place was no use, so we came back home. And of course, Alec came with us that time. And my brother in Edinburgh, and we had that pearl today. That pearl did £600 or £700 for it, if not £1,000. And he got £40 that time in Edinburgh for it, and he thought it was very well paid. You know what I mean? It just shows you how the times went on. But from then, I got married and had seven of a family. I've got five alive. I've got three daughters and two sons alive. I lost two. And I've got 20 grandchildren, I've got 39 great-grandchildren, and I had just worked lately that there's another four great-grandchildren on the way. But don't blame me for that. Don't blame me. That's not my fault. But if I could just have a few minutes to get a wee bit on the religious side of things. Now, none of us could read the Bible. My granny lived to 89 years of age. My mother lived, my aunt, all my generation back, always carried a Bible. They could not read that book, but they knew it was a special book, and they knew it was something that they should carry around with them. Now, my grandmother, when she died, her Bible went in the coffin with her. My mother died, my mother's Bible went in the coffin. Although after I got up and could read a wee bit, I used to read articles out of it to my mother, you know. And then one hymn that I taught her that I learned at a Sunday school, we weren't even allowed at that. I would be about 4 weeks taken into Sunday school, put me out because I was a traveller. Wouldn't take me back then, two cousins and myself. And one hymn that I learned was, and my mother loved it, was What a Friend We Have in Jesus. And she used to love that wee hymn because she knew she had a friend. So we have lived our life by faith. Now, if a minister won't let you in his church, no religious person will entertain you at all. Now, you have to live in some way, and we had to live with faith, and that's something we have, and you can add to it, but we never take from it. My old mother had a saying in the morning when we were young and she didn't have a bite to give us to eat, not one scrap of bread now. She would take her old shawl round her and her basket, nothing in it, empty. She would go out to the door. She didn't say it in the house. She went out to the door and she would say, "May the Lord God be foremost." And my mother never come home with an empty basket. She She had a few pieces, maybe a loaf of bread in this house, a few eggs from someone else, maybe a few potatoes. If it was a foreign place, they would give her a bottle of milk, perhaps some oatmeal. Well, that was a meal for the night. We weren't hungry. But getting around to two very sad things in my life, through religion. My husband was a piper and a stretcher bearer in the Black Watch and went all through the Dunkirk War. He came home and eventually he died with leukemia of the bone marrow. Now he never lived anywhere but Blairgowrie after we got married. All my family were born there. He lived his whole life there practically. So there's a church, I could see it just like about a corner of the room there from my front window. I'm just looking right on the church. And at the back, you can't see it from the window, about 100 yards, 200 yards at the back, is the minister's manse. Now, that minister has been there over 15 years, coming up 16 years. Well, I'll cut it short. My husband died in Nine Wells Hospital in Dundee on Monday, the 12th of May, 1980. Well, it was a natural thing for me to get in touch with the minister. We always take the remains home. So he came down to me and he said he was very sorry to hear of my bereavement, that my husband was a very nice, quiet man. But he sat down on the window seat, sort of a wee seat at the window. He says, my right reason for coming to see you, Mrs. Stewart, he called me, I cannot do your husband service. Now, Alec was all through the war. He did his bit like everyone else, and a stretcher bearer as well, and a piper in the battalion. And I couldn't find words to answer him. I just stood there, you know, and he was sitting. No, I'm afraid it's something I couldn't do. But I'll tell you, I might get someone to do it. I just said, no, it'll be quite all right, sir. I didn't even call him your reverence, which we usually, that's the word we usually use to a person of religion, your reverence. I says, no, it's quite all right, son, I'll get some. So away he went. I did get a minister. And we had the service outside because there was exactly 3 miles measured by the police of cars, bumper to bumper, at my husband's funeral. There were people from, I can't tell you, there were Americans, there were Irish, there were Scots, there were every type of people, English, all came to my husband's funeral. And there were 2 ministers came. We got one, but when we landed at the cemetery, there was another one waiting. And there was a wonderful service there, most wonderful service. And of course we had a piper, a cousin of his own. But that was past and gone and forgot about it. But about 2 years after my husband died, I had 4 great-grandchildren that had not been baptized. We strongly believe in that, for our kids to be entered in the house of God. So I got in touch with him again and he came down and we got talking. What can I do for you now? Then he said, well, I says, I would very much like if you could baptize 4 of my great-grandchildren. I said, the oldest one is 3 and the youngest one is 3 months. I says, you can even do it at my house here, or you can go to their parents' house and do it. Oh, that was a big word. He said, no, I couldn't do that. I was hurt about my husband, naturally. But to think of 4 tiny, wee, innocent, God-fearing babies, he was refused to baptize. But I'll tell you what to do. He says, if you've got a glass bowl in the house, go to the tap and get some water and do yourself. I could have cried right in his face. I says, oh, that'll be all right, thank you. So there was an old minister that used to go around the tinkers' camps when they came to pick the raspberries, and they used to go every Sunday and preach to these travelling people and tinkers. And also a lot of the ladies of the town came, and would bring old clothes, bring food and all the rest of it. But they always did a service on this berry fields to the travelling people. He was a Mr. Leithhead, Reverend Leithhead, but he was retired. But somehow or other, Cathy, that's my oldest daughter and myself, we got talking about this old man. And I says, but he's retired, Cathy. After which she says, well, go and ask his advice anyway, Mother. So we went to see this old minister, took us in, gave us a cup of coffee, sat talking, and then I told him what I wanted him to do. Oh, he says, that should be no problem. But he says, I am retired, but I have a young man doing my work, but I always like to go to be in the church on the Sunday while he's doing my service. So he says, if you go home, he says, I'll come up to the house later on. So his wife drove him up to the house, and they both came in. And he said, well, could you come on Sunday, an hour after the morning service? And we said, oh, yes. He said, well, come to the church. And I thought when he said one hour after, that he was wanting all the people away, you know, so that we could go in. When we got there, the organ was playing, the full congregation was there. And we were taken in with our two ministers. And I've never heard such a beautiful, lovely service. And my four great-grandchildren at that time. So I'll let you people judge what you think of the one man from the other, I don't know. But we were always brought up in the faith of a higher power. And judging from the hardship we had, the life we had to live, the punishment, the way we were despised, if there had not been a higher power guiding us, I wouldn't be here till over 80 years of age. And I still believe in that higher power. And I never knew my own father, dying when I was 7 months old, but I still knew I had a father, and I still have.
Phyllis Marks?
One of my sons always told me
I'm sorry if I spoke too long. Sorry, I'm taking up the time.
One of my sons told me that I could talk 5 minutes on any subject, but I'm going to surprise him tonight. I'm not going to do that. My name is Phyllis Marks, and I live in Gilmer County. I was born at Sand Fork. And my mother got scared by a bear, and it chased her, and she climbed over the wall, and it climbed over the wall. And that was before I was born. 6 months later, I was born with bare feet. I can't beat any of these stories.
We don't want you to beat them. You just tell what you want.
But I think that they were all good. And I want, now that we've moved into Glenville, off of the farm, and due to my condition, my husband's old, we can't farm anymore. I've got something to tell people on Camden Flats where I live, that how to get rid of their cats. I've learned now what they can do with their cats. We all have banjos.
Yeah. I was
poverty stricken like the rest, but I said today I wish people hadn't told me, because I thought everybody had good times and bad times, and our house was always open to everybody that wanted to come, and Mom told stories and sang songs, and we liked the old ballads, but most of all, and someone brought that out too over there, and I can't add to it, laughter is the best medicine, whenever we can laugh at ourselves, and it really helps us a lot. And her part about the faith, we had a lot of faith too. Mom would invite the preachers home to dinner, and I'd wonder what in the world she was going to put on the table. But she always had a good meal. And so I had four children, and I have seven grandchildren, and they all know some of these old songs. Crystal, that I brought with me, she's doing better than the rest, but they all know some of them. And the grandchildren know them too, and one of my sons, when he was, he hadn't got married yet though, but his girl he was going to marry, she said,
Sometimes land just breaks into the most peculiar little ditties. I don't know where it hears. I think singing, I don't have the talents that these others have, but I think singing and keeping these old traditions alive, and you can always learn something, like how soon I have a banjo.
You want a banjo, do you? Well, we might make you one there, some awful good.
We've got about 20 cats in Canada.
Is there somebody from the audience who had something to ask before? Yeah.
I would like to ask these good people, anybody can respond, because you've all come from a kind of happy, no matter what the circumstances, we all seem to be real happy. And I was just a little bit younger than you, and I don't remember those happy days at all too much, I'm sorry to say. And I'm wondering how you feel about progress and what we got now, and push buttons and all the gadgets, and if you think is it worth it, what we're paying for what we got? Like you want to say about that?
I'd like to say something.
All right.
You can't stop progress.
That's what I said. Anyway.
You can't stop progress, but you can live with progress. You can have all the faith you want in whatever you're doing, but you can't stop progress. Who can stop a tide? You can't stop progress. What we are doing today is, I think it was foreseen. I think it was supposed to happen. We're supposed to adapt ourselves to anything that the good Lord put here on earth. We are His children, and we are raised up in His faith, and He puts that here. We didn't put it there. He put it here. We don't put anything here. All we do is wear out what He put here. And if we go along with whatever He put here and put ourselves in straight harmony with whatever He put here, we wouldn't have no better place in the world to live than here. It's for you to live and go. It's for progress to come and go. The push buttons that we have today, in the old days, they had just as much as we have today. But it looked like to me they did more with what they had than we are doing with what we have today, because they are the cause of us being here. And with the push buttons here today, getting rid of a lot of things that we have in place of what we should have.
Getting rid of your brain.
That's the main thing. I think that what we're really up against is faith in ourselves and whatever we have to use, and faith in each other.
Yeah.
This is why so much conflict in the world today. We don't trust each other, and we don't have faith in each other. In the olden days, they had faith in each other. That's when we are here today. If they didn't have faith in each other, I think they'd kill off everything that was out there, and we wouldn't be here. So this is why I say we should teach our young to have more faith, and so it'd be more prosperous to them to live by the modern methods than it was for us to live by our old-fashioned methods. If we can make it on old-fashioned methods, they can make it on the new ones.
I had all kinds of questions, smart aleck questions prepared, and I don't think any of them need to be asked. I think, really, we've heard from each of you so much more than I thought we would in terms of just giving of yourselves, of your story. And in the interest of time and not keeping you all here much longer, I'd like to ask, since I started out by referring to some of his remarks, Utah, I'd like to ask you to maybe say a few words or ask any of the panelists a question, since you're not going to be here after today. I know you have a lot to say about this subject.
No root, no fruit.